Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of a natural gas program at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today, all the way from Toronto, by Naziri Ihezrinka, who is here to discuss the key messages from his recently published paper, Canada's Carbon Tax Hike and Strategic Implications for the Oil and Gas Firms. Naziri, welcome to this OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. Well, look, why don't we start with a general question on the Canadian energy environment? How would you categorize the current Canadian government's attitude towards the oil and gas industry?
That's a great question. I would, in simple terms, I would say it's considered to be a necessary evil. You know, it's a key resource that supports hundreds of thousands of jobs, but something that they would love to get rid of given the chance.
That's interesting because it seems to me that, you know, we're going to talk now about the federal carbon tax hike. And it seems to me it's rather surprising. Can you perhaps tell us about the underlying motivations behind this hike and how it fits kind of with the Canadian government's attitude?
Absolutely. The timing is certainly curious and has been commented on. Prior to the carbon tax hike, I think there was a moderate wing of the current government that was in favor of working a bit more collaboratively with industry, it seemed. The leader of that wing, Bill Morneau, the former finance minister, actually left the government. And, you know, I think combined with the coronavirus pandemic and a lot of debate and noise about rebuilding greener, I think the government felt that this was the right time to release this, and this would be the time that would have or result in the least negative impact on them.
So, Zira, can you tell us a bit about the tax? How much is it? And also, are firms obliged to pay it?
Yeah, so the current tax, it is an existing tax. It's currently set on a sliding scale from starting from last year till 2022, all going from $20 per ton of CO2 to $50 per ton of CO2. The expectation was that it would be fixed at $50 per ton of CO2 from 2022 onwards. However, the hike is now that it'll start increasing after 2022, so starting in 2023, by $15 every year, reaching a final value of $170 per ton of CO2 by 2030.
That's an incredible hike. So industry must be furious, aren't they?
Absolutely, and they are obligated to pay the tax. Either they pay the federal tax or they pay provincial tax. But the provincial tax schemes are only applicable if they're considered to be equivalent to the federal tax.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. So they don't have to pay both. They pay one or the other.
Correct.
But I understand some provinces have actually challenged the federal government's jurisdiction over carbon tax policy in court. You know, what is the current status of these cases?
So there were three court challenges. One by the province of Alberta was actually ruled in favor of the province. However, the government was not obligated to cancel the tax. So there's still a question about whether or not that court ruling was really effective. The provinces of Saskatchewan and Ontario both lost to the government at their courts of appeal. So both provinces have now gone to the Supreme Court of Canada to challenge the constitutionality of the carbon tax in general. There is some precedent to suggest that the court could go either way. The government's best argument likely lies in making the case that carbon policy and combating climate change is a matter of national interest.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So in that will kind of force the federal tax to be pushed through, yes?
That's correct, yes.
Who gets the money, the federal or the state?
Typically, it's the provinces ultimately get the money. The federal tax is really intended to be a backstop. Ultimately, the goal is for the provinces to, because again, in Canada, you know, it's a confederal style of government. The provinces have very, very wide-reaching powers. The expectation is ultimate, and they control their resources. The expectation is really for the provinces to use those funds to drive decarbonization and emissions reducing policies and programs and projects within their provinces. And of course, to provide rebates to those customers and industry players who actually are successful in driving down their emissions.
And all of that, I completely understand, and of course I support. But can we perhaps move on now to a broader discussion on the oil and gas sector in Canada? Could you, for our listeners, set the frame by telling us what the contribution of oil and gas is to Canada's gross domestic product and export revenue?
So oil and gas in 2019 contributed 7% to Canadian GDP. And despite the commodity price challenges that the industry has seen since 2014, really, the absolute number, 120 billion Canadian dollars, has actually been increasing since 2010. Oil is by far Canada's largest export and dwarfs each of the individual manufacturing components. So manufacturing is a significant component of the GDP, but oil individually is bigger than automotive, aerospace, pharmaceuticals, lumber, softwood lumber, any of the other sort of industries that constitute the manufacturing base. Oil is bigger than every single one of them.
That's interesting, because we'll talk about the energy transition later on, but there's a real kind of challenge there, isn't it, between the government seeking the revenue and managing environmental concerns. And how's that? How have they done that? Have they managed it effectively in the past?
It's been a challenge. The previous federal government, I would say the Conservative government of Stephen Harper, again, they made all the right noises about cutting emissions by 30%. But at the same time, they pulled Canada out of the Kyoto Protocol. The current government, again, has made the right noises, demonstrated its commitment by pushing for 1.5 to limit the increase in temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius, when most of the other G7 and OECD countries are pushing for 2%. But at the same time, critics will point to them buying the Trans Mountain pipeline a couple of years ago as evidence of that sort of duplicitousness that really we've seen from the Canadian government on oil and gas issues.
Now, you mentioned, of course, the importance of oil. So why don't we just move the conversation for a few minutes to LNG? Because there is, of course, one LNG export project under construction in Canada, and that's the Shell-sponsored LNG Canada project on the West Coast. Do you think that LNG can inject some life into Canada's natural gas industry?
Absolutely. For me, LNG along with hydrogen is key to the longevity of Canada's natural gas industry, especially because in the last few years, there's actually been a bit of a slowdown in the talk of natural gas being a bridge fuel in Canada. And I think we're probably going to see a decrease in domestic consumption, which combined with, again, the continual discovery of new natural gas reserves means that we absolutely need to get natural gas out of the country or find other uses for it. So I think LNG is your best bet for export. And of course, building out the hydrogen economy is probably your best bet for increased domestic consumption.
Yeah, because the large volumes of gas, which of course you have in Canada, is really truly stranded gas, isn't it? It's physically not near the coast. So there have been some other LNG contract projects that have been proposed in Canada. What is the current state of these projects?
So LNG, I'll say that, it sort of ebbs and flows. COVID certainly, I think, has increased the feeling that perhaps most of these might be dead on arrival. But I will point out two or three that I think do have some legs. LNG Canada Phase 2. So the partner Shell and its partners have actually started talking about kickstarting Phase 2 even before Phase 1 is commissioned. Rockies LNG is another one that's looking at bringing gas from Alberta to BC and, of course, to the coast, to British Columbia and then to the coast. Rockies LNG is still very much in the early stages, but again, thinking about some of the partners behind it and the motivations they have, you can almost, and I think they will be using a lot of existing infrastructure. I think there's a strong case to be made that that's one of the ones most likely to go forward. Kitimat LNG, which is backed by Chevron and Woodside, was probably, along with LNG Canada, one of the two high-profile projects. Woodside recently wrote down its investment in that project by $720 million. So now there's some question about, will this go ahead, won't it? I still think it will. I still think it has legs. It's a good asset. It's a good resource. But I think it's maybe been deferred by a few years now.
Right, of course, you mentioned that LNG Canada Phase 2 is a possibility. That's very often the case in LNG projects, from my understanding, because they actually can keep the contractor on site potentially to do the expansion, and that saves, I have to say, quite a lot of money. So that does make sense if, of course, the market and the gas and the economics make sense.
Absolutely.
Well, look, you've mentioned some of the headwinds that the energy sector is facing in Canada. What about oil sands? Can you share with us the factors that have allowed oil sands to remain, as you put it, relatively profitable?
Absolutely. Oil sands firms, over the past 5-6 years, they focused heavily on acquisitions, consolidations. They've driven down operational costs significantly, in some cases by up to 50%. And they've debottlenecked existing facilities to unlock new barrels without having to spend the same level of capital. I think the long life of the oil sand asset base, in many cases, even after years of production, in many cases, they still have another 30, 40 years of proven reserves at current production rates, means that the biggest risk associated with a sort of the soft market, the current soft market, which is access to cheap, plentiful finance for capital projects, is one that they can actually manage without as long as they're generating cash flow. It's not ideal, of course. And certainly COVID, I think, has exposed that soft underbelly of the industry, that they really need to be getting volumes to market in order for them to generate cash flow and fund sustaining projects. That being said, if you look at their performance from a cash flow generation and an earnings standpoint since 2013, in many cases, for at least two or three of the largest oil sands players, they're actually more profitable from at least from that basis in 2019 than they were in 2013, which is shocking, and most people don't know that.
And most people don't know. But are you insinuating that securing the finance for new oil sands project is challenging?
It's extremely challenging to secure finance. We've seen a lot of investment funds pulling out of oil sands. We've seen, HSBC announced that, they would not fund oil sands projects going forward. Even in Canada, there's a lot of vitriol targeted at banks that continue to finance and fund, oil sands. So companies are increasingly relying on being able to finance these projects through the cash flow that they themselves are generating.
Now, of course, with the Biden presidency starting in the U.S., there's been the recently announced cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline. Now, materially, this impacts takeaway capacity for oil sands crude and signals potentially a return to production curtailment in Alberta. Do you think that's true?
It's not a popular opinion, but especially in Alberta, but I think fundamentally the impact of Keystone itself is minimal. There are two other pipeline projects that are slated to come on stream, one later this year, that's Enbridge's Line 3, and then next year, of course, the Trans Mountain expansion, which the Canadian government owns. Together, these will add takeaway capacity of about 1 million barrels a day, which is more than what Keystone was going to deliver. Secondly, I think forecasted growth rates for oil sands production is currently it's more conservative than it was a few years ago. And I think the need for all of that additional space is just isn't there. And then finally, what I would really suggest may end up creating more roadblocks down the road is the cancellation of Energy East pipeline a few years ago. That was the East-West Canadian pipeline that would actually, I think, have allowed refineries on the East Coast, rather than importing crude from places like Saudi Arabia and offshore West Africa, would actually have been able to use Canadian crude and create another outlet for oil sands crude. My feeling is the appetite for oil sands crude in the U.S. will probably be filled by Line 3 and TMX when those finally come online.
Yeah, interesting. So the market basically is being created within Canada rather than real. And of course, that displaces imports of oil, which is good for the economy as well.
Correct.
But you've mentioned a couple of times, Naziri, the COVID-19. So why don't we just talk about that? Because we've all been shaken globally about this. How do you see COVID-19 impacting on the recovery of oil and gas industry in Canada?
So I think in terms of demand, I think many analysts have pointed to, recovery is not likely to happen to pre-COVID levels until about 2023. So I think we'll continue to see firms making some of the same decisions that have allowed them to balance the market so far, well, to the extent that they can. Pulling major turnarounds forward so that they can be ready to capitalize on the rebound in demand when that happens, voluntarily shutting down production in some sites, you know, especially in the mining facilities where you have trains of production and you can take one or two offline safely, and then pushing towards the production of higher grade or higher value crude grades, you know, so sweet synthetic crude oil versus bitumen. You know, with sweet synthetic crude, you can basically capture WTI level prices versus bitumen, where you're capturing Western Canadian Select prices. We're talking of about a $12 to $15 a barrel spread in terms of value.
Okay, Naziri, we've talked about the energy transition a couple of times already in this podcast. So can we move forward to discuss that in more detail? I think the question I want to ask is, what is the size of the prize for firms looking to invest in decarbonization technologies?
So I'll say the size of the prize is essentially avoiding a massive tax bill, you know, starting in essentially 2025 and going out and going beyond that. So if you look at a firm that paid, let's say, a $40 million carbon tax in 2019, where maybe that was acceptable and something that could be absorbed by the business, that same firm, assuming nothing changes between now and 2030, would be paying close to 250 million Canadian dollars a year in carbon taxes. And that number is only going to go up. So that firm essentially is asking themselves today, are we better off investing $1 billion over the next few years to ensure that we can not only stay in business, but also avoid this massive tax bill?
Yes, so certainly. It's a carrot and stick form of taxation, isn't it, Naziri?
Yes, it is.
Now, there is some skepticism about the readiness of the technologies like CCS. Can you perhaps provide some insight into CCS's applications in the Canadian oil and gas industry?
Absolutely. So again, something that most people may not already know, CCS is being used. CCS, I would consider CCS to be a proven technology. It's being used in enhanced oil recovery at some projects. You know, CNRL certainly uses it, and they've referenced that in a lot of their sustainability reports. We know that, of course, the Shell Quest facility in Fort Saskatchewan in Alberta is used to extract carbon from the hydrotreating process for the Shell upgrader there. And I believe they've captured about 5 million tons of CO2 since the project was commissioned. The challenge is, of course, like most new technologies, is around the cost and the imperative to use it widely. Cost-wise, it's close to about $100 Canadian per ton of CO2 to capture, compared again to a carbon price of $30 per ton in 2020. Logistically, there are not too many storage options beyond well reservoirs, but that does have to be handled. But I'll say right now, I mean, the incentive is clear to scale up CCS adoption, improve storage, and of course, find some more creative uses for CO2. And I think that'll allow the CCS market to explode.
But which other technologies have breakthrough potential then when it, you know, comes to decarbonization across the kind of well-to-wheels value chain?
I really like the idea of using captured CO2 to generate electricity. There's a pilot project right now that's planning to use molten carbonate fuel cells. COSIA, so that's the sort of Oil Sands Innovation Alliance. The oil sands companies essentially have clubbed together to solve some of these mutual problems. So that's one project that's being piloted at the moment. It allows us to utilize CO2, which is, I think, something we need to do, not just store it, but utilize it, while at the same time selling excess electricity to the grid. Another one is the increasing use of solvents and electromagnetic waves to warm up in situ reservoirs rather than using steam generated from natural gas combustion. I think these two together, along with, of course, carbon capture in general, could significantly reduce upstream emissions from oil and gas.
And, you know, there's a lot of talk, certainly in Europe and Asia, about hydrogen. So what role can hydrogen play in the Canadian economy?
The most promising role for hydrogen right now is in displacing as much natural gas as possible in distributed systems, whether that's for heating or for electrification. Longer term, perhaps liquefied blue hydrogen in lieu of LNG as a way for natural gas reserves to access international markets. That might be something that could actually allow us to unlock, you know, the natural gas reservoirs that we're challenged to do today.
Interesting. So from your experience, therefore, you know, what is the most likely strategic approach with all these different options for oil and gas firms in Canada?
The nature of the long life reserves, particularly for oil sands, but certainly for gas, because we know there's a lot more gas, you know, trapped in the Rockies, means that firms are unlikely to abandon their investments. Operationally, CCS is likely to be widely adopted, especially in conjunction with natural gas-fired cogeneration boilers. Firms are also likely to explore lower carbon fuels in line with Canada's clean fuel standard. So, for example, ethanol and then biofuels generated from waste and other organic material. This will allow them to retain market share, because that's another concern. It's not just about even getting the barrels to market, but it's, do you have a social license to continue selling fuel to customers? Done well, I think both of these moves could reduce total emissions associated with fossil fuels by over 50%. Finally, I think most of these firms are going to become bigger players in the electricity market and will either pioneer or back firms and innovators in terms of developing a CO2 market.
Interesting. So therefore, with that in mind, what are the messages that the main players, governments, environmentalists, and the oil and gas industry should be communicating when it comes to the carbon tax hike that we've been talking about at the beginning of this podcast?
You know, this is almost a perfect scenario for everyone involved. For the government, you know, it's very clear. We're supporting the industry, but we're taking the necessary steps to protect our future. For environmentalists, well, it's better than nothing. We're going to take money out of the big oil players' pockets, and we doubt many of them will be, you know, financially viable when this is all said and done. For the oil sands firms, it's actually very simple. This is a matter of survival. It's a challenge we have to meet. There's no ambiguity anymore. It's very clear what needs to be done.
Interesting. Well, look, Naziri, I always like to end up my podcasts with a general forward-looking question. So perhaps I can ask you to look into your crystal ball for a minute. And can you tell our listeners as to how you think it's all going to play out in Canada?
Yeah, it's always a tricky question because, you know, we've seen lots of ebbs and flows since mid-2014. I think we're going to see more consolidation in the space. We've already seen Cenovus acquire Husky, you know, which allows them to not just become the third largest player in the Canadian industry, but also gives them access to more downstream resources, more international assets. I think CCS will be economically viable and widespread in terms of adoption by 2025. I know that's a bit sooner than some others think, but I don't think there's any other choice but for that to happen. This, combined with the other steps that I explore in the paper, should allow firms to meet those ambitious targets that the government is setting. Now, will that be enough to ward off those who are determined that the industry should fail in Canada? I'm not sure. Will the goalposts be shifted again, you know, for the firms? I'm not sure. We certainly have a track record for doing both of those things.
Yeah, but what you've also said earlier on is if these firms don't react now, they're going to get hit with potentially huge taxation in the 2030s. Well, look, Naziri, thank you very much for your time. You know, I've really enjoyed our conversation on your paper, Canada's Carbon Tax Hike and Strategic Implications for Oil and Gas Firms, that's been recently published by the OIES. You know, it's been really great talking to you, and hope you, the listeners, have enjoyed this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.